From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at Rice University, where researchers set out to determine whether conservatives and liberals have different views about how to support people in need. Well, it's no surprise that, yes, there are big differences. It starts with the kinds of organizations that people support based on their politics. Researchers report that Republicans and conservatives tend to support causes that espouse respect for authority and tradition, loyalty, and purity. Democrats and liberals tend to support causes that feature equality and protection from harm. But here's an interesting place where there is some agreement. Very few people, conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrat, give their time to causes they support. I said time, not money, time to causes they support. That means they will write a check, but most people will not volunteer. That means they rarely make any physical contact with people truly suffering, people in need. Now, on the political left, this might be what you could call lifestyle liberalism. You have beliefs, you share those beliefs in various ways, you might give to charity, but you live in a way that insulates you from seeing the real problems up close. Today I've invited Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff to come on the program and share his views on the subject. Pastor Nikoloff comes to us from the South Wedge Mission, a church with a reputation for social justice advocacy. And that can be, well, the whole subject of this hour can be a little thorny. We don't want to confine the subject to a short soundbite or a canned debate. It's a complex question. And Pastor, I know you're not here just to guilt people for the hour, but we're going to try to have a good, frank discussion. So I always enjoy it. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks.
How are you feeling about the overarching subject yourself when you think about?
Well, I think it's important, you know, in the Lutheran tradition in particular, and in a lot of recovery spirituality traditions, we believe it's important to start our time together with a confession of admitting, like, hey, you know, I'm an alcoholic or I'm a sinner or whatever. And I think the same goes here. It's not so much a condemnation of self as much as it is being honest of where we stand. And we're two white, straight males. I went to Fairport High School, Princeton University, and Duke Divinity School, and live in the South Wedge. So I am probably a poster child of privilege, of white, straight male privilege, trying to come here and talk about what it means to do justice and work with the poor. So I acknowledge that position, and in some ways it probably prohibits me from speaking truthfully more than it allows me to. And I think it's important just to acknowledge that, like, these are thoughts from someone who's in recovery from privilege as opposed to someone who has mastered it or transcended it. Okay. I'm sure someone's not listening now and will come on later and probably say that again, but I think it's the kind of thing, like, if we try to make it a purity test of, like, we have 100% pure intentions, we'll be talking about it until we die rather than starting to do something. But we have to have the conversation, even though part of the reason it's hard to have it is that it makes it uncomfortable for us to acknowledge where we stand in it. To be honest, that we're not really standing above it, looking down, trying to help, but we're probably as much a part of the problem as we are attempting to be the solution. So, you know, this is said as someone who's very much trying my best and failing my best as well at trying to be more than a lifestyle liberal, but probably enjoys that lifestyle more than I should as well.
Well, so. Should I offer a little confession of my own then, since you're our pastor for the hour?
Sure,
So I grew up in the Fairport of Cleveland, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio,
okay.
Very much like probably Fairport or you know, the various districts on the east side of Rochester. And on the subject linking into last hour, we were talking college admissions and advantage and how admissions happen and what's appropriate. And so I got in. No, I did not get in. I got waitlisted at the Scripps School of Journalism at Ohio University. And, you know, my dad knew someone on the board. So voila, I'm in. Mm. Now, I could ignore that and tell you I worked hard and now I've made this career for myself. But I'm standing on the shoulders of a lot of other people.
Absolutely.
And I'm very, very well aware of that. And it started early for me. So so I take the point you're making. Now, you know, though, I get emails from listeners who say every time I talk in this way that it sounds like virtue signaling, that it sounds like I'm just, you know, I'm just trying to be part of an elite crowd or.
Oh, sure.
And I assured this listener, number one, I think I always appreciate feedback and criticism. And number two, I try not to virtue signal. I am aware of what that is, you know, the right sort of terminology and language that signals you believe a certain thing, et cetera. Well, my beliefs as a talk show host don't matter anyway, but I certainly am not trying to virtue signal. I'm just trying to represent how I'm seeing the world in these conversations.
Absolutely. And I would never, ever disparage or be ungrateful for how hard my parents worked and how hard people in my life worked so that I could be in this place and be able to have a voice to share. And hopefully the key is not so much to virtue signal or try to, you know, absolve ourselves from you know, you can't just say, oh, I said I was bad beforehand, so now, you know, you can't hit me later. Like, please, let's have a real discussion about that stuff. But it does acknowledge where we're standing in the landscape of the issue, right? It acknowledges that we're in the thick of it and that in some ways we're not in a position to, quote unquote, save anybody. One of my favorite, oh, now I can't remember who said it, but I believe it's either Oscar Romero or another Latin American liberation theologian who said, you know, if you're coming here because you want to save me, then go away. But if you're coming here because your liberation is tied up with mine, then let us walk together. Let us be companions. Let us be in mutual seeking of our mutual abundance of life. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, like, I need this conversation in order to be more fully alive, to actually be more fully spiritual. And so I'm in need. And if I pretend like I don't have a need for it and I'm just in the position of getting to give back, I would be dishonest to myself as well as to others. And so I very much need to do this work because I want to be more alive and I want other people to as well. And that is not mutually exclusive with also wanting to help people who also have material and or their own unique spiritual needs. We're all individual people, and we come together in community around those things. And sometimes the material needs that other people have are the gifts that I need to receive from them, just as they might need the material possessions I have, but might have something to teach me in my spiritual poverty.
All right, so let's talk about how you define lifestyle liberalism, because that is a term that we hear on occasion. Though in my mind, it sounds to me like someone who is progressive, usually sort of upper middle class, usually white, who will say, you know, sort of the progressive buzzword things, but live a very sheltered life that doesn't force them to actually confront or encounter problems.
Yeah.
Is that how you
say it? Someone who's perhaps listening to Connections right now instead of 1180, Rush Limbaugh show, right? We define ourselves by the fact that we are progressive or that we're listening to NPR instead of Wham 1180 or whatever you call
it. I am not here to compare radio stations.
I'm not saying, but you know what I mean? There's a certain sense of what that is, right? I mean, like, we get a sense of satisfaction. It ticks a box for us, right? I want to be listening to material that I deem in line with my values, and those values happen to be more in line with, say, a liberal perspective or a progressive perspective a lot of times. They're ways of defining ourselves, both for ourselves but sometimes against others as well. There's a great book that I brought with me that I would not recommend because I agree with the author, but because I think his analysis is really important to listen to. His name is Joseph Botton, and he's a Botton. It ends with an M. I didn't want to say Botton, but Joseph Botton, and it's called An Anxious Age. And one of the things he postulates in this book about Protestantism in particular, which, whether we like it or not, has been a huge shaping influence on American culture, in Northeastern American culture in particular, that for many of us, even if we've left Jesus behind, we still want to be about the good things that Jesus said we should be about, like justice and peace and equality and loving other people. And we want to be against the things that we think Jesus or God or the good would be against, right? Like racism and oppression and war and violence and all these evils of society, right? This is a view that was popularized by Walter Rauschenbusch in what's often called the social gospel. And he was an educator right here in Rochester and was a preacher here in Rochester at Colgate Divinity School for many years. And what Botton suggests in this book is that the social gospel enabled a lot of us to keep the parts of Christianity we really liked, aka the justice and the peace and all the good stuff that Jesus taught, and to stop being against personal evils and, you know, pointing out the foibles of our, you know, whether we are, have a sexual or an appetital, that's not a word, is it? You know, some sort of personal foibles that are bad, and to instead transfer that sense of righteousness to the kinds of social convictions that we hold, and then to feel that we're righteous because we're against the wrong kinds of things too. So for example, even if we don't go to church anymore, we consider ourselves good people by doing good things like voting a certain way or by aligning ourselves with certain causes or by making sure that we respond with the appropriate amount of sympathy or outrage or outcry when something bad happens, right? Making sure people see us doing those things, making sure that people see that we are good and that we're doing the right kinds of things.
Social media, Facebook posts,
the kinds of things we talk about maybe around the dinner table at holiday parties. And it's not to say that those aren't sincere things, but the locus of what makes us saved individuals, if you will, or good people in our society has shifted from where we go to church or what kind of church we go to or whether or not we are morally pure to whether we are, in a sense, socially pure, whether we have these like right kinds of progressive beliefs. And so I think lifestyle liberalism is more than just kind of a consumer thing. That it's not just about forging an identity out of particular consumer choices like social justice or liberalism or NPR, right, or WXXI. And it is also, it says something about who we what we think makes us good people, what it means to be a good person, right? Everyone wants to be a good person. I think we all desire to be good in some sense. And lifestyle liberalism, at its core, is a sense of it defining what it means to be a good person and to lead a good life, to have the right kinds of convictions that lead to the kind of world that we want to see.
Okay. So I'll ask you just directly, not to, and again, this is not to disparage anyone in the listening audience or your congregation or otherwise. This is just to kind of have an honest conversation, knowing that you might occasionally categorize yourself in this way.
Absolutely.
Are people disappointing you these days?
I disappoint myself certainly abundantly, and I think it can be really disappointing. You know, I mean, who's talking about the synagogue shooting anymore? 2 weeks after it happened, right? 2 weeks, 3 weeks after mm-hmm. it happened, I haven't heard anything mentioned about what's going on in Pittsburgh at that synagogue. Who's talking about Haiti anymore, right? We were so heartbroken. People pour out these Facebook posts of, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening again. We talk about how it makes us feel. I feel so bad, in order to identify ourselves with being kind of in the right, being on the right side of things against what we perceive as the social evils of the world. But have we followed through in terms of working against cultural anti-Semitism? Have we done anything to alleviate the economic disparity between the United States and countries like Haiti in the ways that our prosperity has in some ways come at the price of their poverty? I'm not saying I have solved these things any better than anyone else or that they're easy solutions, but right, we forget about them as soon as they cease to serve us in helping to forge our identities around these things. One of the hardest things for me was a few years ago during the Democratic National Convention before the 2016 election, when everybody is raging against the current president and how racist and oppressive and all that stuff that he is, and he is. But when it came out from those leaked emails that came out that Hillary Clinton was using anti-Semitic techniques and against Bernie Sanders, there was no outcry about anti-Semitism in politics. There was no saying, oh man, maybe our candidate has some issues too. It was very much, but Trump, he shouldn't have gotten those emails in the first place. We're very quick to identify ourselves with the right side of things, but it's much harder to look inside at the ways that our own kind of identity participates in those injustices as well.
Is this similar in your mind to, I'm trying to think of his name, Jon Favreau was a speechwriter for Barack Obama, and on Twitter he posted a picture saying that look what our policy has wrought at the border, saying, you know, this was a few months back, I think it was back in the summer when, especially when the family separation issue was happening at the border. But the picture that Favreau posted turned out to be an Obama-era picture, indicating that even in the Obama era, they weren't necessarily pulling children away from families, but that he was known as a deportation president, especially by those who have a certain view of immigration. But you are much less likely to hear progressives condemn Obama for that than you are to hear them condemn Trump for something that's happening at the border.
Absolutely.
Is that similar?
I think so, yeah. I think at the end of the day, we are still tribal. We still identify with our side of things. And whether or not we think we've transcended the kind of competitive nature of identity politics, like we still want to believe that our side is right, and our rightness often comes at someone else having to be wrong. And I think it's the job of spiritual communities and of political communities that are acting healthily to muddy those waters and to continue to bring a diversity of voices together in order to help us see a more truthful and thick picture of reality rather than one that's easily dichotomized and then used to divide people. It's not in anybody's interest that we stay divided around false binaries, right? Except those who wish to keep control of people by making sure that everyone else stays divided. And it's a really easy way to divide people by helping you to be against something mutually, right? I think it was Carl Schmitt, who's one of the Nazis' favorite political philosophers, who basically said politics is founded on having a mutual enemy. And in some ways, lifestyle liberalism, we have a mutual enemy. They're called Republicans. They're called the rural people. They're called anyone who disagrees with us and is intolerant. They're racist, right? All that stuff that kind of, if you listen to the other radio station at this hour, they're saying, we do say that stuff in a lot of ways. We do accuse the deplorables, right? As soon as Hillary Clinton dropped the basket of deplorables line, suddenly we have someone we're against, and we also know who we are. We're not those deplorables. We're not the people in pickup trucks with Confederate flags and MAGA stickers on our trucks. We are the urban elites with our progressive views, which are morally right and will triumph at the end. And whether or not we like that, that sounds like a pretty good narrative. I want to say, yeah, of course, I'm not racist. I'm not trying to keep people out of my country. I'm not trying to do all those things. But it's like, at what cost, right? Maybe if we had listened to more of those rural folks or people who are different than us in a more constructive way that wasn't so polarizing, nobody would have been so compelled to vote for such a polarizing figure in order to feel like they were represented in the public sphere.
Is that,
you know, we're journeying away from serving the kind of the poverty question, the social justice question, but I think that these things have a spiritual root. Matters of the good, matters of who we ought to be, matters of who we are and who we aren't, matters of identity, they come from the story we tell of ourselves, and the story that we tell about ourselves is often spiritual.
And so Matthew Martin Nikoloff from South Wedge Mission, my guest for the hour. And listeners, if you want to weigh in, we can take your phone calls and emails. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The extension, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, the extension that I think I hear what you're drawing is, we have dichotomized, we've got this bifurcated country. You're on one team or another, on basically on politics, which means most issues. And, you know, just speaking, because again, you're speaking generally from the left, you meet a lot of people who say, well, I'm not that. I'm not the other side. As if that ought to be good enough. But they may live a certain amount of privilege, and by so living, you know, maybe contribute to problems, even if not intentional, whether it's climate, in economic injustice, et cetera, lack of equality. And they may write a check, but they're not doing a lot of work to meet people who are really hurting, the ones who are the least advantaged, the most disadvantaged in society. They just feel like, well, I'm on the right team. I'm on the correct team. And, you know, I can tweet that. I can jump, throw it on Facebook. I can tell you at a dinner party. I can drive a Prius, and that's good enough.
Yeah, feels good to say too. Feels good to get up and be able to say those things, you know. And to those are because those views are beautiful views. To be for justice, to be for equality, to be for human rights, to be for the kind of country where we can welcome people from other countries who are in need and seeking shelter. Like, those aren't political issues. Those are, I think, they get down to what it means to be human. In my particular religious tradition, and in many of religious traditions, we believe that we are made originally good and beautiful and wonderful, and that we're made in the image of a divinity whose heart is for love and for justice. And so as human beings made in the image of this ultimate love and justice, how can we not want those things too? I think it's actually a really beautiful thing that I think everybody wants the best for their children. And I think most people would say they want just a society where everyone can flourish too. Very few people want a society where some people's goodness comes at the expense of others. I think that's a very hopeful thing about humanity, that whether or not we believe that that comes from a deity or it's just something that we as a society have evolved as a common value, like, it does come from somewhere deep in us that I think is still really sincere and really good. So it's not to disparage any of that desire to want to help. I think it's actually a very holy and beautiful thing. But I do think that what can happen is, like so many good things, we find ways to use it to our advantage rather than to use it for the advantage of all of us mutually.
What's an example?
So what we've been talking about is a great example, right? I mean, this idea of it's a wonderful thing to want a society where we have destroyed the evil and the cancer of white supremacy. That is very much an objective legacy of our country and of the way that we've treated people of color in this country in particular. If we start to use the struggle to overcome white supremacy as a way to feel superior to other people, not only have we commodified that struggle, we've also made it all about us rather than about the people that it's actually meant to serve. And what should be our role in that struggle is not so much that we get to say, hey, we know that white supremacy is bad, all you stupid people out there who don't agree with me, and more like, holy crap, I'm white, which means I've probably benefited from white supremacy, and what are the steps I need to take to start to actually not just be able to talk about that on my Facebook page, but actually change the structures in my life that are benefiting from that? What does it mean to say, realized in my corporate boardroom that there's no people of color on the board, and to say maybe I'd be willing to give up my seat so that there's equal representation. There's, well, not equal, but certainly the start of some representation. Yeah. Like, it's great to tell other people they should do that, but are we willing to give up our seat for that? That's hard because it means sacrificing. It means doing the thing and not just talking about it. It means having to be around situations that expose the things about ourselves that are really difficult. When we come up against injustice or we come up against other people, we have to deal with what makes us deeply uncomfortable. And ideas insulate us. They keep us safe. They keep us feeling like we're in control. They keep us feeling like we have, I think, a sense of security in a really messed up and confusing world. You know, I don't slight anybody for wanting to have some points of certainty. I do think it's ironic that it's the critique that's often leveled against conservative people of religion, that they are people who hide behind their Bibles and their guns and all that kind of stuff, like the former president said. It's often seen, religion is often seen as this place where people go to hide from difficult things and to find simple answers.
That's, you mean when the left is caricaturing the right?
Absolutely. Yeah, certainly. But ironically, I think we do the same thing because we're human and we're afraid of suffering and afraid of change. It's just, it feels nicer when the thing that we're hiding behind is anti-racism or fighting white supremacy. But if we're doing it in the same way, it doesn't matter what words we attach to it because the actions might be the exact same on both sides. We just have different language that we're using to express the same kind of core practices.
So in other words, the people sort of in a privileged bubble will divide into two groups. They will argue it out in the public sphere, but they will both be not impacted in any material way, that they are comfortable, whereas the people who are truly suffering, they see no change. Even if a large swath of the population, in this case, in your view, the political left, is espousing a desire to help them.
Yeah, I mean, do the 13 statues of Frederick Douglass around our city and naming a bridge after him change the fact that we're one of the most racially divided cities in the country with one of the highest rates of child poverty, which disproportionately affects people of color, and our school system is beyond broken, and we're afraid to even admit it because we'd rather try to fix it ourselves than getting outside help from the state or other people? Like, yeah, we would much rather point the finger at the South or at the rural people or at people not like us than deal with the fact that, like, part of the privilege we have to sit around and talk about those things has come at the cost of a deeply racially divided city. But because it's got the Frederick Douglass name on it, then we must be okay, right? We can point to the things that we like about it without having to take the difficult parts of it, the work that comes with liking to enjoy having those people as our icons or inspirations, you know?
Is it hypocritical to live a life where you say those things, but you don't live in a way that makes change for people who are oppressed?
Yes, but I mean, that's why I go to church, because it's like a place to go when you're a hypocrite, where you can be honest about it and then try to do something about it, you know? I think we're all hypocritical about something, and I think we're all hypocritical about a lot of things. Each person kind of needs to examine those things for themselves, but I think any spirituality or community engagement we have worth its salt should help us to start to unpack those things without shame and help us to see, oh yeah, you know, I actually have been fooling myself about that. How can I take some steps out of self-delusion? Because my self-delusion isn't helping anything. It's only making the matter worse. That's why I likened it to recovery work in a lot of ways. We're kind of addicted to this picture of ourselves as like benevolent and good, as magnanimous, as people who are on the right side. And I think true spirituality as well as true political discourse should give us the courage and the imagination to say, what if I'm not so right? And what if there's more I have to learn? And what if this vision of a beloved community is something we haven't achieved yet, but we can start working towards? That means we can have hope. Versus, I think so much despair comes in Rochester and other places. We despair because we're like, we thought we had this great city where everybody puts Rochester as best on their bumper stickers and drives around like that, but we can't fix our school system. And we just despair. Rather than admitting maybe Rochester isn't the best. It's our home. We love it. It's not the best. How can we start to work so that it can be better? How can we take some real steps towards being better rather than just taking some half steps to try to keep convincing ourselves that we're okay? Because that hasn't been working, you know?
Can I ask you to share a story that you told me off air that I think is instructive here, though? You're going, what story are you going to ask me to share? I think you'll be okay with sharing it because I think it's really... It really illustrates the challenge here.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we talked about Christmas gift giving on this program, holiday gift giving on a recent program, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Victor made the point that people like to do the good thing, write a check to a cause that matters, but not the God thing, which is actually do the work hand in hand with people without judgment, without looking like you're not a white savior. You're not looking down at somebody. You're not here to be a hero. You're here to do the work alongside fellow human beings who may be suffering or don't have the advantage that you do. That's hard to give up your time to be there, to be among the people who are in crisis and need. But that's a more important thing than just writing checks, because we have continued to insulate ourselves from problems. And we sort of say that we care about problems, but we never have to interact with it if you're in privilege, if you don't want to. And the story that you indicated to me was when you actually do the work, for example, if you're working at a shelter, you may have a vision what that work will look like. And then the work is hard and you question certain things. And it can maybe even be so daunting that people who take that first step, which is a hard first step to take, go, wait a second, what am I doing here? I think I'll just go back to writing checks. Can you tell me a little bit of that story?
First of all, I do want to say, if you're writing checks to support charitable organizations, please don't stop. It's awesome.
Like, yeah, that's not the point.
Any organization, like, you know, as long as the values and what the work that they're doing and the money is going to the work that they do, like, if one of the gifts you have is that you happen to be in a position of where you're able to do that, then, like, please keep doing that, you know? And then keep asking the questions. You know, see that as I took the first step of writing a check, and then ask, okay, what's my next step? It doesn't mean, do I need to be better? Am I not good enough? Stop asking these questions of whether we're good enough or not, and start asking the questions of, like, okay, what next step can I take? Because it's a never-ending journey. We've never arrived. We've never achieved or mastered justice so much that we can just stop where we're at. And part of the joy of that is that justice is not something separate from living. Love and justice are part of the same fabric. I try to say to a lot of people that I really don't want the Southwedge Mission or any Christian church to be identified as a social justice church. In some ways, I loved, even though I don't like his views, what Glenn Beck said a few years ago, and he was like, don't trust any church that has social justice on their website. Do you remember that? He said that a while ago.
Yeah, but why do you love that?
Because I think if we need to say, look at us, we're doing social justice, then, like, why aren't we not just doing the social justice?
I see. It's the same thing as we tell our kids. Like, you don't need to go brag that you are smart or that you are kind.
Right. Just be kind. There's a story in the New Testament where this rich young dude comes up to Jesus and says, look, I've kept all the commandments, and, like, now what do I need to do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus is like, don't pat yourself on the back for just being a decent person. Like, we all want credit for, you know, I think we're used to the gold stars and kind of getting recognition for everything we do. And it's like, just do the good thing because it's good, you know? Part of being a disciple of Jesus is trying to redistribute your resources so that everyone has enough. Part of living in a world where the vision is abundance means just doing the stuff without trying to get credit or be rewarded for every little thing we do. I think capitalism wants us to feel rewarded by getting the thing we wanted anyway, and then getting to tack red onto the product. Or part of your thing goes to help some nonprofit somewhere that you'll never see or care about because it makes us feel good and we're more likely to buy that product. And again, thank God for organizations that try to run charitably. But, like, just do it. No one needs to know that you did it, right? So I think sometimes, like, we treat justice as this, because what that does is it makes justice this optional thing that we then tack on when we have time. It makes it into a committee, or it's like, there's some people at church or some people in my office or some people in my community who do that. And that's those people over there. And so it's their work and I'll farm it off to them and I'll just write my check, versus seeing, like, all of us are a part of the polis. All of us are part of the city. All of us are part of the citizenry. Many of us are part of spiritual communities, which means we have even more of a impetus to believe that all of humanity is connected in this one big family, which means we can't just treat some people like it's optional to care for them. We might not be able to care for every single person because, you know, we're only human and we have all sorts of stuff. But to treat it as it's somehow something that we'll get to later, or we'll get to when we're ready, or we'll get to when we're able. I think on the best, it might scare us because we might not think we're ready to do it yet. And at our worst, it might just continue to be an excuse not to ever do it, or to just make sure that it's a nice branding aspect of our church's website rather than a living practice that we do that gives meaning to the words that we say. So all that is to say, I think if the guy who's writing the check to the organization is doing it from a really sincere place and he's just doing it because it's part of what you do in life, there's something really holy about that. And if, like, I'm doing all the social justice stuff and posting about it all the time on my website and talking about it all the time, but I don't actually get out and do much, then, like, there's some work to be done there, right? I don't think that it's a zero-sum game. I think we all need to look at the steps that we need to take next and try to do that. And I think communities can help give us that context and then help each of us to discern the steps we need to take to continue to be more fully alive. And part of being more fully alive as a human being means being more involved in the struggles and the celebrations of our fellow human mm-hmm. beings, whether they're material or spiritual or whatever.
Would you caution folks that if they start the work, and I mean volunteering time, giving of their time and their energy, whatever that work looks like, it may not always match up to like the idealistic vision you have in your head?
Oh, it will almost never measure up. But sometimes it's because the idealistic vision in our head is something that serves us rather than serves the common good, right? It's this vision of me coming in and people being so thankful and saying, thank you so much for this gift, or thank you so much for being here and serving me tonight at the homeless shelter. Like somehow they're supposed to be grateful for us, right? When they have nothing else in their life going on except to be grateful for us for being there. Like somehow we're the center of that drama. And the reality is, like, one of the rough lessons that I think our spiritualities should teach us is that we're just not the most important person in that room. It doesn't mean we're the least important, but like, if we truly believe every single human life is of infinite value, that's irreducible, whether people vote against it or whether people decide because of convenience or inconvenience otherwise, those lives are important too. That person had a long day, you know, panhandling on the side of the road. And if they don't have the energy at the exact moment we came by and somehow worked ourselves up to sharing a dollar or two with them, and they weren't as grateful as we'd like them to be, like, who are we to deserve that extra moment of their energy just because we gave them a couple bucks, right? And that's hard because it confronts our ego once again, right? It confronts this uncomfortable truth about ourselves that we really do want to be recognized for the good stuff that we do. We really do want credit for it. We really do want to, in a lot of ways, get that good feeling from the work we do. And we do need that good feeling. We need to feel joy. Like, life should not just be about suffering and about joyless sacrifice. I think part of abundant life is feeling joy, but joy is not always happiness. Sometimes joy is just the deep sense that what I'm doing fits with the fabric and the grain of the universe. And if, like Martin Luther King said, the long arc of the universe flows towards justice, then to know that we're in the flow of things, that can give us joy, even if it doesn't always feel good.
Well, and just to kind of put a fine point on the notion of you might not always encounter gratitude, there are economic systems that have really hurt people. And if we are people who are advantaged by that system and we are visiting with our time and maybe contributing some efforts to help those who are disadvantaged, we're not saviors here. And we're acknowledging that there is something that's not sort of systemically and inherently unfair. And it shouldn't just be a celebration because we walked in the door for an hour. But I've experienced that same kind of push-pull myself is, you know, well, that wasn't a whole lot of gratitude. You know, like, as if it's about me. Like, I'm looking for gratitude porn.
Right.
You know, which is just a terrible thing to be doing.
Well, let me tell you a story from when I was in seminary. I was the president of my Divinity Student Council. And Duke Divinity School is known for its work on race theology and trying to dismantle racism from a theological perspective and all sorts of great stuff, and had these amazing... all these amazing black professors. When I was at Princeton, studied with Cornel West. So I have the pedigree, right, of being intellectually immersed in kind of at least in African-American studies and theology as a subject, right? And so, of course, as the president of the Divinity Student Council, I'm like, we need to work for racial reconciliation and in a more inclusive community here on campus, especially in this southern Divinity School that's built on the land that was formerly a plantation and still very much is full of people from cultures that don't value African-American voices. And publicly they will say so, right? And so I spent my whole year in office really trying to create better community spaces in the Divinity School where people could come together and have conversations, and definitely made sure that certain voices were privileged in our meetings and in public addresses, et cetera, et cetera. Like, tried to be the good, you know, like, I'm going to help for racial reconciliation, right? And I got to the end of the year, and I was talking to my friend Brandy, who is one of the, who's now a professor and an amazing theologian, who also ran the GLBTQ student center there. And we're sitting in the office, and I'm like, I think people really hate me. And she's like, yeah. I was like, but why? I was trying to help. I was trying to like make the school better, and I was trying to, you know, work for equality, and I was trying to do all that stuff that like Dr. Carter said we should do, and et cetera, et cetera. She goes, yeah, but you never came to a meeting. You never showed up at the Black Caucus meeting or at the GLBTQ meeting. It's like, well, yeah, I was so busy doing all this other stuff. She's like, yeah, you were so busy like talking for us, but you didn't come and listen to us and just give of your time. You didn't bring your body into the space. And I really valued that voice because she wasn't shaming me. She wasn't trying to shut me down and say, you're out of it. You're one of the bad people. She was trying to help me see a blind spot. She was speaking truth into my situation. You were doing the best you knew how to do, and you were still very much acting within your privilege system, right? It didn't actually do anything good for anyone that you set yourself up in this kind of messiah place. It sucked to hear that so bad. It really hurt. I was crying my eyes out. But she didn't give up on me. She said, look it, like, show up. Start putting your body in the places where your mind is. We have a tendency, I think, certainly Christianity has had this struggle ever since it started with the body, what we do with our bodies, not just what we do with our minds or our feelings, but our bodies. One of the first movements that the Christian church deemed heretical in the first couple hundred years of Christianity was Gnosticism, which is something that I think a lot of liberal folks tend to like, right? It's this idea that we don't need rituals and we don't need all the material stuff in religion. We just need to be enlightened in our minds, and then we can kind of be freed from all that like religious-y stuff. We have this enlightened position. We know what's the truth about life, and our job is just to continue to get away from all that old religious stuff, including Judaism, by the way, and this old heresy. And one of the reasons, and again, there's a lot of espousers of Gnosticism these days, of disembodied feeling and thought. Our bodies are just these things that, like, you know, like, and by bodies, I don't just mean the physical body we have, but structures, communities, religions, politics, all that kind of stuff. And the reason the church rejected it as a heresy was not just because there was a bunch of, well, there's no white dudes in the church at that point. They were all, you know, Middle Eastern and African folks. They were men. But they didn't just reject it because they were men. They rejected it because, A, it disparaged the body. This idea that what we do with our bodies matters, including where we put our bodies, how we use our bodies, what we do with our money matters. The other thing that rejecting this embodied nature of spirituality did was it meant that only people who were privileged enough and elite enough to have the time to sit around and contemplate great truths could benefit from this, and that they believed that Christianity as an embodied religion takes seriously the material conditions of the poor. It takes seriously the material conditions of abandoned babies, especially abandoned female babies that the Romans thought weren't real human beings and so left them to die on street corners. The early church was not known for its theology. It was known because it put its body where no one else is willing to go. When St. Patrick came to Ireland, he didn't just kick out all the snakes. He abolished slavery because he was a slave growing up. So from its earliest roots, the Christian church and other religions have taught that we need to be embodied. But the tendency always is to leave our bodies behind and go to our feelings or our thoughts or our Facebook posts and have this enlightened religion where we can kind of hover above all the messiness but still feel like we're enlightened and saved. And I think the call of all true spirituality of any tradition is to say, it's not a theory, it's a practice. How do we get our minds and our bodies and our hearts back into the fray? Eat where it hurts us, where there's suffering, where there's change, where there's things that we can't control, but where we also discover like real people, right? Where we can actually be there for one another. We can actually touch and suffer for and with one another, and also celebrate with each other. So I think that there's a Gnostic influence, a Gnostic stream in kind of lifestyle liberalism, which as much as it says it's concerned about material conditions, sometimes we like to keep it at the level of our feelings and of our thoughts. And it's very anti-incarnational. It's, in some ways, it's another form of despising the body, and we need to get our bodies as well as our thoughts into things.
Matt writes to us and says, "Evan, who is this pastor? Where is his church? Are they taking new congregants?" Okay, Matt.
All the time.
Matthew Martin Nikoloff is the name of the pastor. Matt, thank you for writing. Yeah. Tell the listeners who are just jumping in here where you're from. You're from Rochester.
Yeah, well, I like I said, grew up in Fairport. Our church is over on Caroline Street. It's called the South Wedge Mission. It's a ecumenical mission start. So it started about five or six years ago now. And we're both Lutheran and Episcopalian, but like in terms of our formal denominational affiliation. But a lot of the people who are part of the community are from all sorts of different backgrounds, including some people who are not from a Christian background and who don't necessarily identify as Christian now. And I think, as much as I like to say all this stuff about, you know, embodiment, I think one of the main things that we try to focus on as a community is what we call a practice-based faith. Not that we have the right answers and then we start to practice them, but that we need to practice first in order to discover what we truly believe. We can say anything we want, but it's our practices that help us to actually discover what it is we believe when we're in the trenches or when we're, you know, in the places it matters. So we focus a lot on practices and on formation. We try to learn a lot from our Buddhist and Jewish brothers and sisters about what it means to practice even when we don't feel like it. I'm a musician, so I really like the idea that you need to practice your skills every day even when they don't feel good because the freedom comes later. You don't get it up front. You have to work for it, kind of a thing. But that you don't practice in order to become holier than other people. We need to keep practicing so we can actually be holier for other people. I think lifestyle liberalism often becomes this way of being holier than certain people rather than a way that makes us holier for people, that makes us more available for the struggle, that converts us in our hearts so that we can come to a meeting and say, what do you need me to do? Rather than, hey, I'm here. Did you recognize me yet? Because I'm here. You know, did you see that I was here? Saying to be servants when we show up, you know, which is certainly like a struggle I've had my whole life.
Well, that really encapsulates so much the notion of, are we doing things for ourselves, you know, so we can kind of signal that, or are we doing things for others? I'm way late for our only break. My gosh, it's 1:47. And I have some other listener comments that we're going to get to in just a moment with
Great.
Pastor Matthew Martin Nicolau from the South Wedge Mission. I think a timely conversation, especially this time of year. Let's get that only break, and we're right back on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. We're glad to have Gary Puttup working with us behind the glass today. And thank you to Gary and Rob Braden for sending along this note here. That just the quote that the pastor was referencing, can I read it in full here? Is that all right, Pastor Nicolau?
Sure. Yeah, okay. Please.
So the quote comes from Lila Watson, an Australian Aboriginal rights activist, who said, if you are here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. That's the idea.
Totally. I mean, one of my favorite pieces of religious art is from, it's a picture of St. Vincent de Paul, who basically created the modern social welfare system in France back in the 17th century. And it's this icon. I used to be part of a Vincentian one-year volunteer community in Colorado. It's a picture right on the wall, and it's a picture of St. Vincent with a loaf of bread, and he's holding, well, it looks like he's holding it out to this beggar, right? But if you look closer, the beggar obviously has the standard beard and, you know, looks very Jesus-y, right? And it's not clear in the picture who's receiving and who's giving the bread. At the end of the day, like, they're both receiving and they're both giving it, right? This idea that the word companion means with bread, right? To take bread with. And I think any practice that doesn't ultimately seek relationship and mutuality is not true justice and it's not true service. You know what I mean? So I think at the end of the day, we don't just need relationships because it means we're better than just a check writer, right? It doesn't step us up to like the next level of being a good lifestyle liberal. It's actually taking us a step closer to what true justice really looks like and what true true healing looks like for everyone, right? Justice is ultimately about healing broken relationships in our world, relationships that are broken and damaged by systems of oppression and systems of selfishness and competition and injustice. So without that relational component, we're not really healing anything. We're just replacing one problem with another.
All right, here's Don who writes to the program and says, Evan, everyone in Rochester has privilege if we compare ourselves to people, for example, in Uganda. Shouldn't we focus justice efforts globally rather than on those who happen to live near us? And if so, isn't the only practical way to do that to just write a check? And he goes on to say, why would some people say we could actually do both, help those here and abroad? If you acknowledge how much more privileged we are than people abroad, then why still help the poor in Rochester who are so much better off comparatively?
I would say definitely do both if you're able to. I would say that each person needs to discern what they're being called to do with their resources. I definitely think there's people in other countries who are way less privileged than us. Like, we can acknowledge that without batting an eyelid. I think one of the reasons that we need to take care of people in Rochester is because we have both benefited from and caused their suffering, right? The Crescent versus the Southeast Quadrant is not just something that is that might people living in the Crescent in low poverty rates might still have more than people in, say, a developing world country. But we have more of a direct connection to the people who live across the river, if we take the time to look at it, than we do with people across. We're connected to everyone, right? We are. But I would say, are we more afraid to go across the river and meet some of our neighbors because it's harder to look at and what it might drag up in us? It's a lot easier to think about those people who are very far away and we'll never meet, right? It's kind of like the inverse question that people used to ask in college all the time, like, if someone lives on a desert island and they never hear about Jesus, are they going to be saved or not, right? Or are they going to hell if they never hear about Jesus, mm-hmm. right? It's this theoretical other that we never have to realize, or we never have to deal with or anything, but it's like, I don't know, I think that it's a tough question. I think, again, everyone has discernment around that, but I do think we should start local and start close to us because we can form more of a long-term relationship with the people that are closer to us if we are willing to put in the hard work and also have our butts kicked a bit, you know?
Yeah, and I would just say to Don, I mean, I think it's a well-intended question, but it implies that just because there is more suffering comparatively on a scale elsewhere, it doesn't mean there isn't really valid and difficult challenges and inequality right in our midst here. And there is. Colin writes to us and says, good show. Fascinating to hear a different voice gently calling out the endemic virtue signaling for what it is and calling for positive action. Nice one. That's from Colin. And Pastor Nikoloff, I wanted to ask you before the hour's up just a little bit about, I took some heat from listeners last week, from some listeners. I don't know if it's representative of the entire population of listeners. but from some listeners who heard some remarks I made about Kevin Hart, and I just said, you know, Kevin Hart is the comedian who was going to host the Oscars, right? Mm-hmm. And then decided he wasn't after there was this big outcry because people dug up some of his old comments about if he had a son who had a dollhouse, he would break the dollhouse because that's for girls. And I said, my feeling is there's two things about that as a father of a son. I think that's a toxic view that contributes to so much of the weird, like, just gender stereotyping that we're just kind of addicted to, which I think is toxic. But I also said, I wouldn't run him off the Oscars for it. I want to have a conversation with him. And not so I can teach him the way of the world, but just so we can talk to see how people evolve and change. And sometimes my fear is that we play this role of proving that someone says things that's out of bounds with social justice goals. And if we can just prove that, we can shame that person. And we spend a lot of time on social media shaming.
Kind of sounds like church, doesn't it? That's some people's view of, right? It's what humans do.
And I'm not saying don't evaluate comments and possible impact, but I am sure someday someone will find something I said somewhere that I would not feel good about having said or written, and maybe I'll get run off this perk. I don't know. I mean, I feel like, boy, none of us that I've met so far are perfect here. Is there too much of that happening that we sort of look to kind of police past comments and look for evidence that someone is impure to a cause?
Well, yeah, it goes along with this idea. I think, if our liberalism or progressivism is more about us having an identity that we own, that we feel like our value is tied up within, then we'll be just as likely to police, defend, and even use violence in defense of that identity as the people that we sometimes accuse of doing those same things, right? Those people that we despise with that identity. Which is why I think this stuff all comes back to heart work, which means I think Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, said, you know, that the real revolution that's needed is a revolution of the heart. At the end of the day, like, whether we have lots of money or no money, whether we have really great ideals or we have the worst ideals, like, we all have a heart that has room to grow, and we all have things that we can do better. And again, the internet makes it possible to have these disembodied criticisms of other people without engaging, rather than trying to offering a conversation, right? The intersectionality of, like, the Kevin Hart incident of, like, yeah, there's a lot there to be offended by around gender stereotyping, but it comes from a conversation that's happening within the African American community and tradition around masculinity and around family and all sorts of things. So it's nice to say, we want you to entertain us with funny jokes about race, but don't talk about gender. We only want the parts of you that fit into the things that make us laugh and feel comfortable. I think we talked about Key and Peele before a little bit, right? And they're pretty good at doing stuff like that, where they don't just stick to the things. Like, they try to offend everybody a little bit, and enough to make us see that, like, we kind of all have something to learn, and none of us has a high horse to sit on. And I think, you know, whether or not Kevin Hart should have said that, it raises the conversation. And we should certainly say that's not a great view. And we don't want to have a place for that in our society, but we also don't want to start to create our own heretics with our view and people that we've decided to burn at the stake without a trial. Mm. That's the thing that kills me is like what most people don't realize about, say, Nazi Germany was it wasn't the crazy racist conservatives who started it. It was the well-meaning liberals who helped to start it were well-meaning liberals. The Hitler Youth was one of the first Boy Scout organizations that went into rural villages that were suffering from economic disparity and took care of people. A lot of the people who helped to start it were extremely liberal, who said, we don't really want any morality or God attached to these things. We just want to be good people and do things that are good for our society. And it was often the more conservative people who had more of a religious view or more of a metaphysical view who stood against it. So no one is exempt from these kind of ends. But I think the good news is that we are created, in my opinion, in the image of someone who really loves and cares for and will never give up on this world. And if we can find a community that helps us to tap into that kind of joy and grace, then we'll be able to not only work for peace, but hopefully find some peace in the process as well.
Well, you can find Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff of the South Wedge Mission. And I'm really glad you came today. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for challenging all of us. I appreciate that. Our thanks this hour to Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. Gary Putup, thanks for working behind the glass. A well-earned day off for producer Megan Mack. But you know what? She's always working. That's the nature of the job. Hope you're surrounded by love wherever you are this afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.